Welcome to the Intuitive Awakening Podcast. I'm your host, Deanna Riddick. I'm an author, teacher, and eternal seeker of truth. I am on a mission to spread metaphysical knowledge to everyone in an effort to help them awaken to universal truth. If you want to learn about spirituality, the occult, and all things related to metaphysics, you are in the right place. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Intuitive Awakening. Thank you so much for joining me for this week's episode. This week, I'm going to be discussing with you the story of Lilith. And Lilith is commonly referenced as being the queen of the demons, or I think queen of the night as well, which is what I've seen kind of perusing through a lot of this literature. However, another title that she can take is that of being the first woman that was created on the earth. As I said before, at least in the last episode, there are two creation stories in the Old Testament of the Bible or in the Hebrew Bible. This is something I already mentioned, but I think it warrants a review to provide you a semblance of context here. So just referencing Genesis. In Genesis, we read that God said, "Let us make man in our image," again, suspect wording, "after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle," etc., etc. So God then creates male and female in our image, blesses them, and tells them to go off, be fruitful, and multiply. That was the sixth day. Already created them. The heavens and the earth were already finished, the host of them. The seventh day, God ended his work, which he had made, and then he rested on the seventh day from all of his work. And he blessed the seventh day, and he sanctified it. But then after the seventh day, Adam hasn't been created, or at least Eve hasn't been created. He still has to take the dust from the earth, create quote unquote man, and then breathe into it to create life. But there's some confusion here because you already said that you created male and female in your own image, but now you're saying that there's no man on the earth, which is what he says in Genesis. So for us, there are two creation stories in the Bible, but it's confusing because if Eve wasn't the first woman created, and even if Adam wasn't the first person created, and I think that's an entirely separate topic that someone can look into at some point, maybe I will, but for our purposes here, who was before Eve? That is the question, and that is where our friendly first woman, or queen of the demons, if you want to call her that, or queen of the night, this is where she comes in. So in order to begin to address this question, we are going to look at the Genesis and Leviticus Rabbah, or Rabbah, however you want to pronounce this. And again, this is a religious text from Judaism's classical period. Now, in these two parts of the text, the ancient rabbis, they noticed that you have these two contradictory versions of creation that appear in the book of Genesis. And they need to reconcile this because obviously there are so many contradictions in the Bible that need to be reconciled. And if the people are, you know, going to believe in what is being taught here, then it needs to be logical. It needs to make sense and at least needs to proceed logically. So here's their solution to this quote-unquote problem. To solve this discrepancy, they say this, that the first version of creation actually referred to Adam's first wife, a first Eve. But Adam was displeased with her, so God replaced her with a second Eve that met all of Adam's needs, essentially. And according to Jewish folklore, Lilith is considered Adam's first wife. Sometimes she is referenced as the first Eve, but for our purposes and for a majority of these texts that we're going to take a look at today, they do reference Lilith, and she was well known throughout the Talmud and a lot of the Jewish mystical texts. Now, what's interesting here is that Lilith isn't associated with this whole idea of being the first wife until about the medieval period. But she is conceived as the original woman, created even before Eve. However, she is the most notorious demon in the Jewish tradition. Many scholars believe that Lilith was inspired by Sumerian myths about these female vampires that used to be called the Lilu, or sometimes they think this story, or Lilith at least, was inspired by these Mesopotamian myths about succubi, or what we also can call a succubus, which are defined as these female night demons, or somebody who takes your life force from you. But they were also called Lilin at the time. Now, Lilith in particular is mentioned four times in the Babylonian Talmud. The ancient name Lilith derives from a Sumerian word for female demons or wind spirits, the Lilitu. The Lilitu dwells in the desert lands and is especially dangerous to pregnant women and infants. It is said that her breasts are filled with poison, not milk. The Lili, which is also synonymous with the Lilitu and the Lilu, so all of it's the same. You can use it interchangeably. This individual, or this demon, if you will, is a sexually frustrated and infertile female who behaves aggressively towards young men. You'll see that over and over in the literature. What's interesting, though, her name is also translated as the screech owl, or creature of the night. If you look at any depictions of Lilith, you're going to usually see her with multiple owls. So in the Talmud, and this literally comes from the Hebrew word, which means study, the Talmud is essentially a compendium of legal discussions. It includes the tales of these great rabbis and meditations on biblical passages. Now, in the Talmud, there are references to Lilith, but there are just a few. However, they do provide a glimpse of what the intellectuals thought about her. Now, the Talmud's Lilith recalls older Babylonian images in the sense that they depict her as having very long hair and wings. Again, if you look at even modern day depictions of Lilith, you're going to see her with wings, sometimes with owls, sometimes very hairy, and again, yes, with this extremely long hair. Now, in the Talmud, there's this very interesting story about Adam and his possible interaction with Lilith, even though I don't know that they use, you know, that term Lilu or Lilith or what have you. It's almost indirectly implied. I'm going to read it because it's really simple. But during the 130-year period between the death of Abel and the birth of Seth, the Talmud, it reports that a distraught Adam separates himself from Eve. So something, you know, happened. Maybe they had arguments. Maybe he's just angry at her from being expelled from the garden, what have you. But during this time, he becomes the father of, and I quote, ghosts and male demons and female demons. So something happens. Again, there's an implication here that he must have messed around with Lilith to some degree because he was super angry with Eve for what she did. Now, the Bible mentions Lilith only once as a dweller in, I would say, these waste places. So she makes this solitary appearance as this wilderness demon, and she's being shunned by the prophet Isaiah. And I'm going to read you the only passage that speaks of her essentially in the Bible. So it says this specifically in Isaiah 34:14. The wild beast of the desert shall almost meet the wild beast of the island, and the satyr shall cry to his fellow, the screech owl or Lilin shall also rest there and find herself a place of rest. So very strange reference to her, but I think she was also, at least her story was kind of known during that time period, so maybe not an odd reference, if you will. So in the 9th or 10th century, and I've referenced the alphabet of Ben Sura before, but it is a collection of legends, essentially. And the alphabet of Bensoura, it draws on these earlier stories of Adam's wife and of Adam's even coupling with demons, and then introduces this whole new elaborate story in which Lilith, again, is Adam's first wife. And it says this very specifically. When the first man, Adam, saw that he was alone, God made for him a woman like himself from the earth. God called her name Lilith and brought her to Adam. They immediately began to quarrel. Adam said, "You lie beneath me." And Lilith said, "You lie beneath me. We are both equal, for both of us are from the earth." And neither of them would essentially listen to each other. As soon as Lilith saw that nothing was going to change, that Adam, you know, wasn't going to acquiesce, essentially, she uttered the divine name, if you will, or I guess God's name, and then flew up into the air and fled. Adam began to pray before his creator, saying, "Master of the universe, the woman that you gave me has fled." So God immediately dispatches three angels to go after her to bring her back. So God says specifically, if she wants to return, well and good. And if not, she must accept that 100 of her children will die every day. The angels pursued her, and they overtook her in the sea in these raging waters, the same waters in which the Egyptians would one day drown, and told her what God's orders are. And yet, she didn't want to return. And they told her that they would drown her in the sea, and she replied, "Leave me alone." And I'm reading verbatim here. "I was only created in order to sicken babies. If they are boys from birth to day 8, I'll have power over them. If they are girls from birth to day 20. When they heard her reply, they pleaded with her to come back. She swore to them in the name of the living God that whenever she would see them, these three angels, or their names, or their images on an amulet, she would not overpower that baby. And she also just accepted that 100 of her children were going to die every day. Therefore, 100 of the demons die every day. And therefore, we write the names of these three angels on amulets of young children. When Lilith sees them, she remembers her oath, and the child is now protected from her, and they're healed, essentially. So they leave her, and then she becomes like Lilith, who weakens the children of men. Now, some people believe that the story is a serious attempt to explain the death of infants, while others are convinced it's just this humorous tale of sexual quarrels and unsuccessful angels. The Lilith of this story confronts both Adam and God. She defies the patriarchy. She refuses a submissive sexual posture. And she, you know, in the end, refuses marriage altogether, and she prefers to just be this demon rather than live under Adam's authority. And she even says, okay, you know, I'm cursed to have 100 babies every day, and they're going to die, and they're going to be, you know, demons, whatever. But either way, I'm not coming back to paradise, and I'm not coming back to Adam, and I refuse to be submissive in any kind of way. So after all of this, Lilith flees to the Sea of Reeds, and this is the place where the Hebrews will one day go free from slavery. So in this version of the Lilith story, you know, she kind of becomes what all tyrants fear. She becomes a person who is aware that she is enslaved, right? So this version of this Lilith tale, at least in the alphabet of Bensoura, it quickly spreads throughout Jewish life, and many others decide to expand upon it. We know that this is a very misogynistic tale. At least there's a lot of this in the alphabet of Bensoura. But like I said, many people come after, they read this, and they decide to kind of make their own spin and elaborate on this. And we see this also in the Zohar. This is a mystical work from the 12th century. It is also, I believe, the foundational work of the Kabbalah. And in particular, it imagines Lilith not only as the first wife of Adam, but also the wife of Satan. Wonderful. And I'm going to read to you now from the Genesis of Lilith, from the Zohar. It's really, I actually think it's quite poetic, and I'm very curious to hear what you guys think about it. So bear with me. It's interesting. It's not going to be bland. In the beginning, God created the sun and moon. They both ascended with equal dignity, but the moon did not feel right with the sun. In fact, each mortified one another. The moon asked, "Where dost thou pasture?" And the sun asked the moon, "Where dost thou make thy flock rest at noon?" Then the sun asked how she, as a little candle, could so brightly shine in midday. God thus interceded to avoid strife between them and told the moon to diminish itself. The moon asked why she should be the one to veil herself, but God insisted, saying, "Go your way forth in the footsteps of the flock." Although when connected with the sun, the moon was equally bright, but when departing, she lost her light and assigned charge of her host, and shells were created for the covering of the brain and for the benefit of the brain. After the primordial light was withdrawn, there was created a membrane for the marrow. And this is also called a khalifa husk or a shell, and this khalifa expanded and produced who was called Lilith. He, or God, summoned to issue from the side of darkness a sort of female moon which rules the night and is called night and is associated with Adonai, Lord of the earth. The left side of darkness flamed with its full power, producing at all points a kind of reflection, and from this fiery flame came a moonlight essence. Just as it is the desire of darkness to merge itself with light, so it is the desire of night to merge itself with the day. By causing a separation of the sun and moon, God ended the discord between them. He caused the moon to diminish herself and go forth in the footsteps of the flock, at the head, essentially, of the lower ranks. In the Zohar, the sun was rightfully the higher dominion, ruling the day, being male, and the moon was rightfully the higher dominion, ruling the night, being female. There are two kinds of luminaries, those descending from above, called the luminaries of light, and those ascending from below, called luminaries of fire. Although both luminaries continued reigning, the moon felt slighted. Her attachment for the sun was severed, and her self-diminishment was not of her choosing, but commanded by God. This diminishment in particular caused, again, what's called a khalifa, or it also means a husk of evil, which birthed Lilith. Lilith has a body of a beautiful woman from the head to the navel, but from the navel down, she is a flame of fire. This essentially represents the Lilith energy, at least according to the Zoharic myths, from the resentment caused by the diminishment of the moon, as well as the dark and fiery side of the night. So we can see here, I think, a really nice metaphorical representation of what happened in, at least what the alphabet of Ben-Sira maybe said happened to a certain extent in the Garden of Eden. In the Zohar in particular, Lilith's demonic sexuality also comes to the fore. In the Zohar, she attempts to seduce men and she wants to use their seed to create bodies for her demonic children. And because of this, the Zohar recommends the performance of a special ritual before sexual intercourse between a husband and a wife, in which the husband should turn his mind to God and say, in particular, and I'm going to quote, "Veiled in velvet, are you here? Loosen, loosened. Go not in and go not out. Let there be none of you and nothing of your part." So Lilith is the seductive harlot all of a sudden who leads men astray. When they turn to her, she transforms into this angel of death, and then she apparently kills them. The traditional depiction of Lilith from ancient Mesopotamia through the medieval Kabbalah is said to embody the most negative aspects of desired human sexuality and family life. Lilith not only embodies people's fears of how attraction to others can ruin their marriage, or of how risky childbearing and raising children are, but also represents a woman whom society cannot control. A woman who determines her own sexual partners. Someone who is wild and unkempt. Someone who does not have the natural consequences of sexual activity. Children. In the Kabbalah, Lilith takes on cosmic power. She is not only God's partner, but she ends up becoming this counterpart to the Shekinah, which is the divine feminine presence, or I think it's also called the Bride of the Infinite. I'm not going to spend all my time trying to go through this entire story in the Kabbalah. That would be like 10 episodes within itself. But these are just various representations of Lilith. So in folk Judaism, the primary myth about her continues to essentially identify her principally as the stealer of babies as well. If you can think anything bad, apparently she's going to embody it. Numerous amulets for pregnant women and babies from medieval through the modern times, believe it or not, use the three names of the angels mentioned in the alphabet of Ben-Sira, and they use their names to ward off Lilith. These amulets, they may also contain a circle with the names of Adam and Eve on the inside of the circle and the name of Lilith on the outside. A clear warning, essentially, for her to stay outside the family realm. A red ribbon is also sometimes placed on a crib to ward her off. An additional practice contains hanging cards from above the bed of a woman in childbirth with prayers written on them as well. Apparently, and this is something I think I'll talk about a little bit later, it was common knowledge, and I do kind of want to really stress this. This queen of the night, this particular demon, this harlot, the stealer and killer of babies, etc., she was well known. And how do we know this? We know this primarily not just through all of this literature. We know this from the material record, which means through archaeology. And this is something I'm going to talk about shortly, but I just want to emphasize it here, that there were a lot of amulets that were utilized against her. And as we can see, there was a lot of extensive work that was written to talk about this person, this woman that everybody hated, this demon that they all feared. So there's another text, and it's called The Just Measure, but its actual title is the Kava Yashar. And this is a Kabbalistic collection of stories. It's also a collection of moral guidance, etc., a collection of customs. However, in the Kava Yashar, and I'm probably completely butchering that, but it's also called The Just Measure, we find a number of stories about her. This text was actually published in 1705. And in this text, we actually find her now appearing in the guise of a beautiful woman who attracts men because she's so beautiful. And it's interesting because in other works, she's still imagined as being beautiful, but only from the waist up, and then a monster who's ugly and hairy from the waist down. Sometimes we find depictions of her in literature as being half man, half woman. However, we also find, and I found this to be one of the most interesting stories, if you do your research, at times she's been equated with the legendary Queen of Sheba, who tried to seduce the King Solomon. In this story, Solomon actually suspects who she is. So he tries to trick her in a way so that she reveals her true self. So he has her believe that the floor that they were on was covered in water. And he makes her raise her skirts so that she has no choice but to reveal her hairy legs to really show that she's this monster. essentially, Lilith is everything that is supposed to go against God. She embodies everything such as sex and power, indulgence, desire, etc. She stood for all of the things in life that distracted men from their true path. She was unafraid to be who she was. However, of course, they condemned her to being a harlot. Okay. As I said earlier, we know of her not only from a lot of this literature, but we also know her from the archaeological record. And her image has been unearthed on numerous ceramic bowls, and these are the incantation bowls, and they have Aramaic spells inscribed on them. I'm gonna try to post pictures on my website so you can see what I'm talking about, but it's quite unique, and this is something I did not expect to find when I was researching her, because a lot of the stories of these goddesses, even the dark goddesses, a lot of people classify them as being very mythical in nature, to the point that there would be, you know, almost no representation of people really believing that they existed. But for her in particular, and I think her stories are very, a lot of people are not informed about them here, at least in this part of the world. So it's surprising for me in particular to find, you know, these pictures, these images of all of these Aramaic incantation bowls against Lilith. So to me, she feels like a real being. Anyway, I digress. Now, the Talmud, it demonstrates, you know, everything that the scholars thought about Lilith, even the Zohar kind of and the Alphabet Ben Zohar, all of this literature represents, you know, her, what this, if you want to call it scholars, priestly, rabbinical way of viewing her in particular. But when we look at the material record itself, when we look at these incantation bowls, we get to see what everybody else thought of her, their perceptions. So there's one bowl in particular that's dated to about 600 CE that's on display. And I I'm going to post a picture so you can see, but it has an incantation written in it. And I'm going to read you what it is, because it just gives you so much insight into how her image was portrayed during that time. Okay, let me read this to you. "Thou Lilith, hag and snatcher, I adjure you by the strong one of Abraham, by the rock of Isaac, by the Shaddai of Jacob, to turn away from the Rashnoi, and from, I'm forgive me if I'm pronouncing this, Ganoia, her husband, your divorce and writ and letter of separation sent through the holy angels. Amen, amen, Salah, hallelujah." Now, this inscription is meant to offer our woman, whose name Rashnoi, protection from this demon, from Lilith. So according to popular folklore, demons not only killed human infants, but they would also produce these depraved offspring by attaching themselves to human beings and then copulating at night. Therefore, on this particular bowl, we have a Jewish writ of divorce expelling the demons from the home of Rashnoi. Very interesting, super informative. And again, we have insight into what people believed about her, what they really feared of her. So we have more evidence from the archaeological record about her. And some of this evidence comes from a limestone wall plaque, which is dated in between 7th and the 8th century BCE, and it was discovered in 1933 in Syria. Now, this tablet in particular, and again, I'll put a link, I think in the description notes I can do that. This tablet in particular likely hung in the house of a pregnant woman and served as an amulet against Lilith. One translation reads, "O you who fly in the darkened rooms, be off with you this instant, Lilith, thief breaker of bones." So it's presumed that if she were to see her name written on the plaque, she would fear the recognition and then she would quickly fly away. Also, this plaque was supposed to offer protection
from her intentions, from her evil intentions towards a mother or their child. I wanted to read you a quick quote from Janet Howe Gaines because I think this is super helpful here. At critical junctures in a woman's life, such as menarche or your period, marriage, the loss of virginity, or even childbirth, ancient peoples thought supernatural forces were at work. To explain the high rate of infant mortality, for example, a demon goddess was held responsible, and I think that that was very common. It was a very common belief. Now, the very last thing I want to say about her is that if you look her up, you will see that she's often depicted with a female face and a serpent body. In some literature, she's often seen as the snake who tempted Eve to take from the tree of knowledge. We see this type of imagery, particularly in the Renaissance period, where Michelangelo, he portrays her as half woman, half serpent, coiled around the tree of knowledge. Now, in modern times, she's kind of become this popular figure. We see this with, you know, the popular Lilith magazine. We know the consort Lilith as well was named after her. And for a long time, she's been viewed as this major source of fear. But lately, she's been embraced as this major icon of liberation, of freedom for women and women's movement. Now, one of her most desired attributes is her ability to seek fulfillment of her goals without concern or regard for what everybody else is thinking. She has no concerns for the beliefs of others or the judgments of other people. And I would say also that, you know, she does provide the model of an independent woman who challenges the system in which she is placed in. Now, for your knowledge, she tends to be categorized as this dark goddess, and I think you understand why. The stories about her are quite scary and horrific, but then we have to remember which lens it's told through, right? And what the intentions were. However, I would say this, that if you're struggling with feeling free or independent, or embracing that side of yourself, I would definitely recommend connecting with her energy. And you can do this by calling her name and even doing some goddess devotional work to kind of embody some of the strife and lessons that she's encountered and learned how she's overcome it as well. But as you see here, the portrait that has been painted in the Zohar alphabet of Bensura, I forget the name of the other text, I think it's the Just Measure as well. Yes, everything is pretty nasty. Her specific story is also, I think it was distorted. I think the fact that she wanted her own freedom, her own independence away from being submissive. Obviously, if we were to historically contextualize that, depending upon the culture in which you're in, you know, there is a specific ideology that's operating and to go against the social norm or the religious norm for that matter, then you're kind of deemed the black sheep or worse, you're condemned. And I think that that's kind of what happened here. So whether you believe in her actual existence or not, it was heavily believed in. And even in modern times, you still have people creating amulets to protect themselves when they're pregnant, or they're even putting it on their walls of their house to protect their, you know, their children as well, because they have viewed her as this demon or queen of the night who's either going to steal your seed and then, you know, have you impregnated with a demon or what have you. There's so many variations of stories I did not get to here today, but I'm listing my recommended reading and also the names of the sources that I use to put this together. Everyone, I really hope that you enjoy today's episode, and I hope that you have a great week ahead. Take care. Bye-bye.